We are going to work. How about that? Let the record show that Representative Fritz, Tischer, Phillips, and Locker are all present. And today we're going to have a work session on House Bill 172. I see that Tamara's not with us today, but Mr. Early Perry, is he going to work with us? I think we're on page 99.
Yep. Article 1, Chapter 45.
And just skip over the easy stuff. But read out the page number and the line number so we can stay with you.
I'm probably not as good at this as Tam is. She's the one who wrote it. I just try to read it. We're going to deal, I guess, with municipal taxation.
Well, she's perfect, and that's pretty hard.
Right.
To get close to perfect. But we'll settle for you today.
Okay, the first major change in the municipal taxation section is under 2945.010. It is actually on page 100, and it's item subparagraph C. And it allows for the optional exemption of either real or personal property by the local municipality. Currently, the current statute says that if you tax real property, you must also tax personal property or vice versa. This will allow the municipality to opt for one or the other.
Our municipality has both.
Well, at the moment, all municipalities have to do both unless they were doing something different prior to 1972.
By common, they're going to still do both, whether this or
okay, I might add that we are not going to, because it costs us more money to collect our personal property tax than it generates. That's truly a nuisance tax, because we've kept track of it.
The philosophy there pretty much is to allow the municipalities to do to form their tax structure the way they want. In the case of Anchorage, for example, they don't have a sales tax. In the case
we'll
of,
have that too.
Well, just a hotel tax. But in the case of Fairbanks, for example, they've been exempting personal property since prior to 1972. So they levy a sales tax, but they don't tax personal property. It allows each municipality to tailor its tax structure to what its constituency likes, I guess.
If it opts out out of this, say, the personal property, would that be done through an ordinance?
Right.
Only?
The ordinance, right. Only. Voted on by the voters.
Only.
Mm-hmm. Ratified by the voters.
Oh, ratified, right. Okay.
And 45020 is not changed. Under 45030, which starts on page 101, there are several minor changes. Under subparagraph 2, it allows for the, it requires the exemption of all household furniture of the head of a family. Current statute allows for mandatory exemption of the first $500 and optional exemption of the balance. And all the municipalities in the state have opted to totally exempt all household furniture. So this just makes it mandatory that they continue what they're doing.
And what was, what page and line?
101,
right.
Line 25.
Oh, 25. Okay, I thought you said 7. Okay. That's new?
It, the current statute mandatorily exempts the first $500 and allows for optional exemption of anything above that.
Okay.
Under subparagraph 4, the last line on that page and the beginning of the next page, current statute provides for the exemption of veterans organizations. This changes that to allow for the exemption of veterans organizations and their auxiliaries. So it adds the auxiliaries to the exemption. Under D, which is down on line 25. In the right place?
Yep. 102.
Page 102. I lost track of where I was. Excuse me. See, Tam, you got this down pat, and I don't.
How I feel.
Oh, I'm sorry, I was on line 15. What they've done here is they've cut down on the definition of what religious property includes, and they've actually taken out some ambiguous language that talked about relating structures and adjacent property. Anything used exclusively for church purposes for their religious services would still be exempt, but this just makes it a little easier to understand what they're talking about.
Any problems with church groups on this?
Not to my knowledge. We haven't heard anything.
If I may,
sure, we will later.
I haven't heard a peep on this, and this change was made in the very first draft of this bill. And mm-hmm. it's never been, nobody's noticed as far as I can tell.
It wouldn't necessarily cut out anything that's currently being exempted. There have been some cases or some questions about a church that might happen to have a parking lot somewhere in the vicinity of the church for an auxiliary parking lot that they actually rent for parking space during the week. And this makes it clear that that's not intended to be exempt if they're using it for that kind of income-producing facility.
I understand that there's some argument going on in my borough about something just about like the Mormons have what they call a farm, right?
A welfare farm, that's
and
right.
And they use the money, the proceeds, for the poor, but they're being taxed now.
That's what's going on at the moment. I have the feeling that that's going to be resolved by court. There isn't a clear definition of that in the current statute or in the new one. Okay, section E through J of the bill deals with the senior citizens' exemptions.
Say that again, that last.
E through J, starting at the bottom of page
19.
They deal with the several different senior citizens' programs as far as senior citizens' exemption, and they make some minor changes that clarify and correct it. Under current statute, when they passed the original homeowners' motor vehicle or senior citizens' household exemption, there was a section in that bill that dealt with the filing of a form. The senior citizen, in order to be eligible for the exemption, has to file a form approved by my office. When that was incorporated into the statute, it was incorporated in such a way it read like any exemption granted to anybody, including the federal government, had to file the same kind of a form. This clears it up and makes it clear that that only applies to that senior citizen's reimbursable program. And another one of the areas that's changed is under the motor vehicle exemption, the senior citizen's motor vehicle exemption, which is item J on page 104, line 14. Under current statute, it says that all municipalities, whether they tax motor vehicles or not, or whether they lose revenue or not, are eligible for reimbursement. So we end up actually reimbursing municipalities who do not lose any money. This would clear that up and make it that we only pay those municipalities that actually do lose revenue. The other minor problem with the existing statute is that a municipality currently does not have the legal authority to exempt a senior citizen from a local property tax on his motor vehicle. This would give them that authority. Okay, item number M on the next page is what the gentleman was talking to you about the other day, and it deals with the definition of developed as it appears in the federal statute. Under the Native Claims Settlement Act and the amendment thereto, there is the 20-year exemption for Native lands under the Native Claims Settlement Act. In there it says the land is developed is exempt from property taxes for 20 years after the date of conveyance unless developed or leased. Then it quits and doesn't tell us or give us any indication what they meant by developed or by leased. This was an attempt, this came out of another bill last year, there was an attempt to define the term developed. It's not my language, I'm not sure whose it is, but anyway, that's what it's in there for, is an attempt to define that word developed as it applies from the federal statute. There currently is nothing in the state statute that deals with that at all. Okay, 45040 on page 106 is the property tax equivalency payments for senior citizens, and there's no changes there, or no major changes anyway. Maybe some wording.
Except that I suspect that if our bill for the veterans makes it in the other house and gets signed into law, it will come in.
It will be included in both the homeowner's exemption and this renter's equivalency.
That was my question.
Under 2945050, the optional exemptions, the only substantial change there is under...
We have a... Can you interrupt?
Sure.
There's a bill in there to make it $100,000, I think, Malone.
There's... Yeah. Also, Representative Malone's bill, at least the one I saw yesterday, would just take it off altogether, the limit.
Oh, I thought it was $100,000.
It would just raise that $10,000 up to... That kind of legislation has been introduced every year since I've been here.
Yeah. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
That's fine. In fact, I hope that you would, as I like past things that you want to ask questions about. Under B1 on line 9, the change there is that currently a municipality has two choices. They can tax boats and vessels at full value, or they can charge them a fee in lieu of that of $5 for all those under 5 net tons and 15 for all those over. This change would allow them to do those things or anything in between. They could charge them, they could assess them at something less than value, maybe 50%. It gives the municipality the option to tax boats at more than one method, more than just that. It makes it more flexible.
Doesn't the borough of Ketchikan now, does not tax boats? What do they do?
No, their boat structure, as does Juneau's, falls under the prior to 1972 clause that allows a municipality to do anything it wanted to if it was doing it prior to 1972.
Grandfather
clause. And both the municipality of Ketchikan and Juneau, and I think even Sitka are under that situation.
And they do not tax
boats. They don't tax boats at all.
Right.
Who does?
Who does tax boats? Municipality of Anchorage.
Valdez.
Valdez doesn't.
Oh, Valdez.
Bristol Bay Borough.
Seward?
Kenai does, yes. The Kenai Borough does.
Okay, and then, you have a boat, right? And does that mean it's got to be at the dock at a certain day or in order to be taxed? In other words, if they had a taxing deadline of, say, January 15th and your boat happens to be out in Prince William Sound, you know what I'm talking about.
In this state, we don't have...
I don't.
Okay.
There are, in many states, laws that say you tax personal property like boats where they are located on a day certain.
Right.
One day of the year, if they're located there, that's where they get taxed for that year. That is not true in this state. In this state, we tax personal property where it spends the major portion of the year. So if they were harbored in Juneau and they happened to be gone the first of the year for whatever reason, they would still pay taxes in Juneau if Juneau taxed boats.
Something like how they count people.
Yeah.
Now that clears it up. Count the legs and divide by two.
On that day certain.
You're not chairman for nothing.
The rest of that section is pretty much the same with some minor wording changes. The next change is to 2945-060, which is the farm and agricultural land and now greenhouses section.
Oh, greenhouses.
Greenhouses.
Under the current statutes, and I think I may have explained this to the committee once before, that under the current statute it just says farm and agricultural land. And that was interpreted for one reason or another to include greenhouses for several years. The Attorney General ruled about 3 years ago that it should not have included greenhouses, so their exemption for all intents and purposes was revoked. This was to put it back.
I'll throw a zinger in here. How about hothouses?
It says that...
they were real technical.
It also includes in here the growing of ornamental plants. So if they were using the hothouse to grow ornamental plants, they wouldn't have to be necessarily food crops. I would think that they probably would be exempt, at least for that part of their...
Like Pacenif?
Yeah.
I think I pronounced it as Pacenif. It was Christmas.
Poinsettias.
Poinsettias, okay.
I thought he was talking about something else.
Oh, no. Poinsettias. Yeah. You know, you can't eat them.
Well, a greenhouse, a hothouse is a form of greenhouse, isn't
it? I know, yeah.
I think that there is a greenhouse in Eagle River that grows them that pronounces that word like you first said it. And I think
Maybe that's where you heard it.
That's where you did, because I have a son that did the same thing. He told me that that's how you pronounce it now. And that's where he heard it.
Well, anyway, those guys grow those plants. Heard a lot of people
around. I thought we were growing babies for a minute.
Oh, he's got, I don't know, two, three of these huge houses there. Row after row, they plants. That's what I was thinking.
Mm-hmm. I understand that this was in there for a specific reason.
Van Lizer, wasn't
yes.
it? Was Van Lizer?
I think that's at least part of where it
is. Well, probably P&M Gardens, too. That's either way. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Cam, do you know the background on why
that's been? Essentially it. You've got a couple of commercial greenhouses that are fairly large in the state that really objected to losing their exemption. And originally they had been granted an exemption, and then the Attorney General changed its mind on what could be granted an exemption and what farm use meant. And so they changed the definition of farm use to include ornamental plants.
Mm-hmm. Well, the greenhouses up in Eagle River Valley are almost as big as the Manlizer's operation now. I think it's probably bigger by now.
There was another major one, I don't remember the name of it.
P&M.
But the one that grows the tomatoes for commercial sale.
Oh, I think that's in your area, isn't it?
No, it's almost downtown, in fact. I've been
there. Oh, really?
But The assessor took me there and showed it to me once when we were discussing this whole issue. And that was the other large one besides Manlizer at that time that was involved.
Have you seen PNM?
I don't think so.
Huge.
Okay, the next change is on under 2945090, it's on page 112, lines 28 and 29. And what this does is makes it clear that if a property tax is levied within a municipality or a service area, that it must be levied the same on all kinds of property. That you can't have separate millage rates for different kinds of property and you can't assess at different levels. Current statute, we feel that that's true, but it isn't as clear as this would make it. Mm-hmm.
No, I find it.
Thank you. Look who's here.
Wow. Welcome.
Are you going skiing tomorrow, Mike?
Let the record show that Representative Zemanski is here. This is a very loose workshop, you may answer, and interrupt the witness at any time, Representative.
Did we ever establish a quorum?
Yes,
oh, yes.
Mm-hmm.
And where'd they all run to?
She steps out for a minute. She'll be back.
Is there seven on the committee?
We have
tomorrow?
A little problem with three Democrats in our neighborhood.
Before 10 o'clock in the morning?
Well, don't we have a...
Yes, we do.
Okay.
Someday I'd like to find out where the hell you can be found. I've got a memorandum from you. Please discuss it. Golly, I can never discuss it with you.
Let's do it on the floor tomorrow. Because we usually got lots of time there, right?
Well, that was a very serious matter.
Okay.
The next change is on page 115, 2945-130. Deals with the independent investigation by the assessor into the records of taxpayers for purposes of taxes.
What line was that?
I didn't say which line.
I thought you said 110. Or
no, it's page 115.
Right. Okay. Wrong page. 130. Okay. That's what I thought you said.
It is 45-130. It deals with the investigation of records, and it allows the assessor not only to get a court order to enter a property, but also to get a court order to ask for a court order anyway, to look at records in the case of personal property.
So it adds personal property?
Yeah, it adds the review of records under the court proceedings so that the assessor can get business inventory records or machine equipment records, depending on what kind of a tax structure they have.
What does prima facie evidence mean?
First,
if I may, it's the minimal amount of evidence that you need to establish your case if no other evidence in opposition is introduced. So that if you can come up with prima facie evidence, then you've got the case licked unless the other guy can show one element, you know, can undermine one element of your case. So it's the minimal amount you would need to make a showing.
Boy, is that ever some gobbledygook the way they got it written, huh?
Well, essentially, the way it works in this section is once the assessor comes up with a valuation, the court's going to take that as being the valuation unless somebody can come forward with something that would prove, you know, positively prove differently. So the burden of proof would be on somebody challenging the assessor.
That's what I had a feeling it would say. And I guess... just gut reaction is that I always get that funny feeling that seems like an odd way to, you're proven guilty before.
The rationale behind this is that in the case of personal property, quite often the statute says that the taxpayer must file a return saying that this is what personal property he has. If he doesn't, the assessor still has to make the assessment. I mean, the fact that it wasn't filed does not alleviate the assessor his responsibility to make the assessment. At that point in time, if that taxpayer wishes to challenge, then he has to bring some records forward. But the assessor still hasn't seen anything. So if he brings some records forward and shows that in fact is the wrong value, then the situation will be corrected. It's an attempt to get them to comply with the initial requirement that they file records that a lot of times doesn't happen.
Does it cut both ways, I guess is the question. If I'm Joe Blow citizen and I'm paying real property tax, I get an assessor's thing that says, hey, you didn't declare your boat and your camper and a few other things out there, and I want to find out how he came up with those dollar figures on that, how he assessed the value on them. and whether or not they're the current real assessed value price. Does he provide me the information?
If you went to his office with your complaint, I'm sure he would show you how you arrived at it, I'm sure. Their records are open. They're
required to do that, huh?
Sure. The first thing he probably would do in that case is, if you hadn't filled out anything, was ask you what you thought they were worth and how you arrived at it, because you know more about it than he does.
Okay, thank you.
2945-140, starting out line 24. Currently changes what is currently a statute as far as failure to file or make a false statement on these returns. Currently, it's a fine of $500. Keep losing my place on the grant. We're going to get Tam back up here. She understands what she's doing.
28.
Well, it's $500 or imprisonment for up to 30 days in both, I think. Oh, my goodness.
That's the current statute, and this changes it to a Class B misdemeanor.
Yeah.
Which is what?
90 days.
$1,000.
No, I can't.
You stand in the corner with a dunce cap on for 2 hours.
Well, we shouldn't be putting people in jail. Now, come on.
Find
them anything you want, but I don't think we should be going to jail.
If I may, Madam Chair, in this bill, throughout this bill, all of the penalties, whether it's for violating an ordinance or violating a land use regulation or anything, they've all been changed to Class B misdemeanors consistently throughout the year.
Then tell us what a Class B misdemeanor.
I think it's 0 to 90, isn't it? 1,000?
I think it's 0 to 90 and 1,000. For a violation, there's no jail time, so I guess there's a chance of jail time to Class B misdemeanor.
Okay, well then that is definitely one that I'd have a problem with.
I can look it up.
Would you please?
The feeling in the committee when they came up with this was that the criminal code, after the criminal code was enacted and we set up these classes of misdemeanors and felonies, that it would be better to, rather than set like $500 and some jail time randomly throughout the statutes, that we ought to pick one or the other of the commonly accepted criminal sanctions and just call everything a Class A or a Class B or whatever. And they hit upon a Class B, but it certainly would be an easy thing to change it to a Class B misdemeanor or a Class A misdemeanor. We could even use a violation, which doesn't provide for any jail time. I think it's only $300 fine.
While we're on that subject, you know, it would never be my intention to jail people for failing to comply with municipal violations that don't endanger other people. But I guess I need to add to that that it was brought before the legislature by the Chief Justices when they gave us their report, that they felt that it was time that municipalities paid for the public defenders that are used against ordinances that are broken, municipality ordinances. And it's a very large sum of money. Not only do these broken ordinances clutter the courts and cost a lot of money, but the state now is paying for the public defender, and it's lots and lots of money. I would suggest to you that there has also been a movement, and I didn't know why, that then the municipalities would also be paying for the room and board of these people who are put in jail. So maybe you better look at this a little bit. I mean, it could be a very large, large amount of money that municipalities would be required to fund. If it starts with the public defenders and then you start putting them in jail, it's only a matter of time until you'll have to pay for that too. Okay, I've got mine marked.
Okay, the next section that has any kind of change in it is 45-200 on page 118, starting on line 4. Deals with the Board of Equalization that reviews the work of the local assessors. And what this does is would give a little more flexibility to municipalities in that it would allow them to appoint a Board of Equalization that could be 3 persons. Current statute requires it to be the number of people on this board to be at least the minimum of a quorum of the assembly. So this would allow it to be a little smaller. And sometimes it's easier to find 3 qualified people to do this kind of a not very fun job than more than that.
Randy?
I think I may have a problem with that. You're making it easier for the municipality. The bottom line is, right?
Well, in most municipalities at this point, the Board of Equalization is the assembly.
Right.
This allows, if they decide they don't want it to be the assembly,
mm-hmm.
then they can pick a board of 3 people. It has to be at least 3 according to this. Under the current statute, it has to be at least the number of people that would constitute a quorum of the assembly.
I think I'll have a problem with that. I just don't want to make it easier for local government, especially when it comes to taxation of individual members of society. I think that, you know, they're, just from what you've said, and I'll have to study this some more, but from what you said, that you're relieving the duties of assemblyman and putting it on to somebody else. And that you're removing that one step away from the elected official to be responsive to the constituency, and I think I'm going to have a problem with that one.
Currently, the assembly can appoint a professional board, and in many cases they have. And one of the rationales there is, and has been for a long time, that the assembly is the political body responsible to make the decision of the mill rate. The assessed value is supposed to be a technical thing that is only the base and should not be affected by political influences. And if you're an assemblyman and three of your constituents come in and complain about their value being too high, it's very difficult for you in that position to be objective about that because they're people who voted for you and whatever. If you make this group a group of professional, in fact, we would suggest, or the professional association suggests, that it be probably an architect, a builder, and a real estate person who are familiar with the real estate market. They can make unbiased decisions on what's right. They definitely are not on the side of the assessor or on the side of the taxpayer, and they shouldn't be, but only on the side of what is proper and fair. Most professional assessment organizations, at least in their code of ethics, talk about a professional board being preferable over an elected one, just to take the politics out of the evaluation process. Subparagraph B under that section makes it real clear that the Board of Equalization is there to hear appeals of individual assessments and shall act only on those individual assessments and shouldn't go off on a tangent and start raising and lowering people's assessed values all over the place, that they're there to hear appeals on specific assessments. That's currently the way that it is in statute. This just makes it clearer. Now, some paragraph C makes it real clear about how you get from that point to court, then that is an administrative matter. And in current statute, that section allows a trial by jury if the taxpayer wishes, and this section does eliminate that.
Let me ask a quick question. Mm-hmm. The validation are found to be, if validation is a little low, Board of Equalizers raises the assessment. Basically, is that just thrown in there because at some point in time they had a problem where some equalization board, it was unclear as to whether or not they could raise it if they thought it low.
Right.
It's kind of interesting little angle.
Yeah, there's been discussion by municipal attorneys on whether or not they had the authority to raise as well as lower. If somebody came in with, for whatever reason, in fact, the situation happened most often here in Juneau, back when we had Juneau indemnification, because the basis for your identified value was your original assessment the first year after construction. So lots of people went to the Board of Equalization and asked to have their assessments raised. And they weren't clear on whether they had that authority.
You guys apparently have more faith in the local government than I'll say myself.
Just because you live in Eagle River.
I will.
We always have problems in this country, is what I'm saying. And I just... Anything you make it easier for the municipality, no matter how innocent it may be, my back's up because, you know, folks back home are going to view it the same way, and I also view it that way because then it makes it easier for them to do what they want to do despite what the constituency says. And I just want to make it as difficult for them as possible. Mm-hmm. You know, and here it sounds like you're trying to make it easier for them, and believing the municipality will do it if it's easier for them. And it's at their convenience and not mine, my constituency.
Yeah, I think that you'll find the underlying thought through this whole rewrite is to make things not only easier for the municipality, but to streamline them and make them clearer. This is the municipal code, and it was dealt with by the municipal league and
yeah,
the personnel of the municipality.
Yeah, but they don't necessarily represent the constituency who we were supposed to be working for in the first place.
Randy, you know, it's...
You know, that's not necessarily my personal views, but I can see that, you know, some of it is, but I'm speaking for a lot of other people.
But you've made a statement that says that municipal government may not, at least in your judgment and the mm-hmm. judgment of a lot of other people, represent the people. I would suggest to you that who best represents the people, and if they do not, who is the most accessible to those people? someone who's right up the street in City Hall, or someone that's 600 miles away and an overshot to Seattle and $700-$800. I mean, really and truly, that little city councilman should be the most accessible to
him. I'm only, you know, I know I'm stepping on some toes with the Natsu and the Kenai area. And apparently, you guys have a real close relationship with local government and the constituency. But I've had a lot of people come to me and other state legislators within our district to handle a municipal problem. I mean, it seems to me that, you know, like one of my questionnaires, it seems like about 6 out of every 9 problems has to do with municipality. And I have to get on the horn and talk to the municipality. I mean,
that's true. But every day, the municipality handles constituents. Every day.
Yeah.
As an assemblywoman, I handled constituents. I don't have to bother with them here.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I'd like to echo some of Representative Phillips' concerns, but I'd like to address a comment that you just made, which is true, that the local government council, borough assembly, or whatever, is the best place for your constituency to reach as quickly as possible and to be persuaded. However, it many times, from the state level or even from the local level, if you're looking at this, there are laws that are being created, regulations that are written, and rules that are propagated by the bureaucracy on whatever level, without the consent and consultation many times of the constituency as a whole, for the efficiency's sake, if you will, as you just demonstrated. And those laws are in place so the municipalities and governments, local governments, have alternatives in saying, here it is, that we have nothing to do with this. The state drew this up and it's passed, and so we have to be governed by that. There's a law higher than us, and so they can pass the buck that way, for number one point. And two, their own municipal ordinances and so forth have a tendency to do the same thing, because I don't see too many people who like the kind of jurisdiction that local governments have, and they've been in place for a long time, and there's always a battle in some way, if you will. You read it and hear it every day, or we wouldn't have long assembly meetings, if you will, and so forth, people saying, don't do this and don't do that. So in retrospect to what Randy is saying, we can all well and good say that local government, and I believe that strongly with you, and I'm in concert with that philosophy, that local government is where the, you know, the ship should stop, if you would. But to implement something that takes away, for example, in this document, every time we run across where there used to be voters' privileges for recall or petition or initiative or something like that, or whatever, we find that more stringent, streamlined, quote-unquote, regulations are written in, but on the other hand, taking away the ease in which a citizen can express themselves legally and take some action and have an effect on government. And so, to me, that is abrogating a citizen's right and giving the right to the government instead, and I don't particularly care about that on behalf of our constituency. Enough said on that.
I'd like to just counter the phrase "express legally." I have not, in the sessions that we set through Title 29 or in the sessions that I helped work on it, ever in any way try to stop a citizen to express legally. What we found was that they were able to actually circumvent the day-to-day ability of local government to function, and I don't think in any way in streamlining those opportunities did we ever eliminate their opportunity to express legally. I do not feel that. If I did, and you could point that out, I would be one of the first people to stand in line to change it. What we did is we allowed them not to bring a local government of volunteers to their knees while the day-to-day work of that government could not operate, such as two city councilmen on a small council like Saldana being recalled or that sort of thing. All we made them do, there was always an avenue for them to proceed, but we streamlined how they had to do it. And you know, if I thought that was the intent, I wouldn't be a part of this, and I wouldn't have been a part of it. I really truly feel
that local government is misunderstood, and it's very easy sitting from here to say that revenues are diminishing and so government must tighten their belt, when in fact this state government has given away dividends and eliminated nuisance taxes and eliminated income tax, and yet we tell the people who actually provide the service, raise the taxes on the property if in fact you cannot live within your budget. So I don't know. I guess I have to kind of think that we're a monster with two heads here.
You're right. Murray, I just don't want misunderstanding. I'm just saying that it's strictly our own problem with the municipality language, and I recognize that for what it's worth. Also, in talking to, like Milo and yourself about your own respective boroughs or local government, it seems like you have a much closer relationship. We don't. That's a fact of life.
But May has a point. We must watch for what she says.
Right, and that's what
and
I'm
we're
saying.
We're not doing that.
I'm saying that, we have our own problem, and I'm just only relating my concerns with our own problem with this bill. And, it's just talking to other people from other organized governments seems to mean that they have a much closer relationship than we do. And we always have to go downtown and fight City Hall. That's all I'm doing is expressing, some concerns in my constituency, and they're not exactly thrilled with government.
I think that Thomas Jefferson said it well. The best government is less government. And Charlie came in a little while ago, and we wanted to give him a 200 and some page, and he said, well, sure, okay, the problem has to be paid when it gets done. That kind of demonstrates what Randy and I are both saying, that sometimes government causes their own difficulties, and that the less there is, the better we may be off. We don't need to guide and direct and hand, spoon feed, if you will, every solitary citizen that lives within the confines of that governmental organization. I'm talking about their daily lives and restricting and ruling and so forth. They're sick of it. They just want to be left alone to live their own life and exist and have some opportunities and be able to stretch their legs without wondering if they're stepping across into somebody else's turf. And daily we see, more laws being enacted on the state level and also on the local level to put out brush fires when, indeed, if we were wise, sage people, we would be looking beyond that and saying, how about putting your own brush fire out, or at least creating the atmosphere in which one could be there?
I would just like to suggest that that's much easier to say when you're a legislator and you're a
human
than it is when you're an assembly person sitting right there where all those people can get at you.
Okay. We're trying people to come to government to help them or do it.
For everything.
Can I ask Samansky, since he's on the other side of the mountain from me, municipality.
Not politically.
Politically as well as geographically. Don't you have the same complaints from your constituency about the municipality?
No, I don't know. I go hot and cold on it. I just went through the last notification of tax increase by the municipality and walked through it with the various constituency bases that I have in the area, and particularly Girdwood, which was the hardest hit of all of them in Anchorage. And what was really unusual from my perspective on it, where there was an uproar associated with it and a misunderstanding and so forth, once the people understood what the whole taxing policy was doing to them or as part of them and so forth, and they understood where the money was going, and they could track it right through to their local library or to their local road improvements or to the pay increase at the two firemen at Girdwood Fire Department and so forth, there was a whole appreciation, a whole different attitude. I mean, it was almost like a 180 turn. They were sitting there with heads on their spears ready to go into a war dance before the thing started, and then after it was all over with, they said, my position to them was, I can't adjust those for you, but I'm sure if you sign a petition right now, they want to eliminate the two firemen at the fire station, they'll take it under consideration and probably eliminate them for you. And if you want to shut down the library at night and not have that service, they'll probably do that for you. Well, no. There was no consensus that they wanted to do it. They wanted the services, so it was put up for shut-up time, and they shut up in that case. But I think there's a lot of misunderstanding about the whole taxing area. Everybody complains about it. Matter of fact, I've got a request going in right now, like I said, research in that area to determine on a lot of communities where we're at nationally.
As far as taxes?
As far as taxes go. My inclination, or one of the reports that I've recently received, indicates that we're about 30% lower in most communities than the national average for the same equal services.
Yeah.
I think that's true.
So,
yeah,
because the state revenue is picking up the balance, right.
Yeah.
But the state is people. It's as much theirs and should be spent locally.
So
I
get the same bitches and moaning, but I don't get much after they understand it.
As long as you touch the firemen, yes, but if you touch the bureaucrats, they wouldn't care.
But Girdwood doesn't have any, so then you'd have
doesn't
to take
have any bureaucrats. You're getting into the meat.
They have administrative oversight from the
Yeah, from downtown.
The municipality.
So we don't have any hard.
We have real active cities and boroughs. I mean, the rooms are full of people, and so the people are a part of our government. And yes, like Mike said, they'll scream and yell when they get right into that budget. And where are you going to cut here? And what are you going to give up? Then they have, when it's all over, exactly what they want. And they insist on it. And they don't hesitate to recall assembly people or whatever. And that's the best kind of government there is, as far as I'm concerned, where the people are truly a part of it.
But there are other ones. I've got another constituency in South Anchorage, Oceanview area, that is next highest increased tax increase in Anchorage area was Oceanview. And they were bitching and moaning just like everybody else. I mean, they know exactly how many times the policemen go through their area, and they know that there isn't a frequency. But they're taxed based on area-wide police protection, and they're a little mad about that. There's not much they can do about it. Should have voted out police service altogether.
Well, it's parts of your district, like, you don't have Hillside.
Yeah,
you do have Hillside.
I've got parts that are under
But they can do that.
Well, yes, they got that option.
That's the beauty of it, is that they do have some options locally that aren't available to people when it comes to state government passing laws.
Yeah. Are the options in the statute?
In our statute? This Title 29?
Yeah.
I don't believe so. Not that service areas.
No, all statutes talk about is how you establish all the taxes. Is there a way that talk about how you get out from underneath them?
Mm-hmm.
Where's that at?
In fact, in the section that we're looking at right now, C is a brand new provision of that particular section, which allows the citizen to directly appeal to the Superior Court in a situation where, rather than trying to contest the amount of an assessment, he's contesting the legal ability of the local government to impose taxes at all. And that type of an issue, we've avoided all of the administrative review on the local level, and the person has the right to go right to the court for determination of whether the property is taxable. For the charitable contributions, or charitable organizations, for the Indian holdings that may be not taxable under various federal statutes, those people no longer have to deal with the Board of Assessors at all. So that is one instance. We have other methods as we go through. I'm sure Terry Early will point them out to you, where people can challenge assessments. And in the area of tax foreclosure, this bill contains a new provision where when property is sold, if it is not kept for a public purpose, but if it is sold, the municipality will now be obligated to return that portion of the proceeds that exceeds the amount of the municipal lien to the owner without the owner having to do anything.